Okay. Time to start again. You were given a very special situation in now where you had the opportunity to sit in groups and discuss this solution. So we had all the possible guidance that you could have. You could filter it through others. You could apply ample time in doing this. If we gave you this task as a, what is a quick decision thing, well, of course, the shorter time you were given, the more of you would give the wrong answer. But the well, actually, if you give people a minute or so to try to think about this individually and give their answers, approximately 90% will give the wrong answer. So it's a pretty common thing to do this in a wrong way. And even given the ideal circumstances that you had here now, there will probably be some of you, or you will probably have different answers. Anyone who wants to try one? Which card or cards do you need to turn over in order to determine if the rule is true or false? Is a suggestion there? That's true. It's always a letter number combination. A and five. Other suggestions? Huh? All four? Others? Anyone dares to? Yeah? There are others who agrees on that. Just A. So, huh? A plus seven? There is no seven here. Oh, yeah. Wow. But the point is, you get to a lot of answers here. How many agrees to the first one? Third? This one? A bit fewer. This usually comes out as the most frequently answer, the A plus four one. Okay, I forgot to start the recording again. Please remind me if I do this, right? So most of you would, in another situation where you individually were going to do this, I guess about 80% would choose either the A plus four or just the A, or most at least would include the A. The correct answer is the A plus five. So one of you who gave this answer, why is this the correct answer? You have to check the vowel, obviously, yes. that's the key thing. Yeah. It's because what would happen if there was a consonant on the back of the four card, for instance? Would that say anything about the statement? No, it would not. Because the statement doesn't say anything about what's on the other side of consonants. Or what's on the other side of odd numbers, for that sake. It just says that if there is a vowel on one side, there is an even number on the other side. So that's the only thing that's mentioned. And but the reason why we do this one, well, because the A is obvious. That's the way to, that's the strategy to try to confirm, or actually to try to, that would be an obvious falsification of the hypothesis, but also a confirmation of the statement. By choosing the number four, well, the only thing you could try to do was to confirm your hypothesis. Well, it wouldn't prove it in any way. It would just be another. You would, of course, support it in some way, in a quantifiable way. It would add the chance that you're correct. But it's not a strategy to falsify the statement. And this has to do with a tendency that we humans have in searching for what supports our hypothesis. It's called confirmation bias, that we always strive to confirm our initial hypothesis. That's our intuitive way, as you could say, human information processors, when we try to get to an answer. But it's also maybe one of the key problems involved in not applying scientific methodologies when you are trying to get an answer to something. Confirmation bias. And that's what we want to avoid. It's one of the things we want to avoid. So we're not good at just applying sound, I don't know, what we call it in English? Student vernunft, sound something. Common sense. Common sense is not it's not a good way to try to get the good answers. Okay, a little step back. When we talk about science, well, what do we? I'll just get to some. The next few slides is. I could choose any of them. They are pretty similar, and they all has to do with the. Because the qualities of good science, you can find numbers of lists similar to the ones that I will show you now, and they all refer to what we think is good science. So, in lack of any, authoritative list, let's just try to go into some of the topics from all of these lists, or that's somewhat in common. I don't know the basis of this one. It's from a book I used a few years ago, where they try to say something about what good science is, and they, for instance, say that a key concept of good science is that you always base your work on what's done before you. So, and this also refers then to this cyclical nature of science. Science starts with a question, and usually ends with a question or ends with new questions. So you start at one point and you end up somewhere else. Good science is has a context, you could say. Another thing is that good science should be replicable, meaning that it should be possible for others to get the same conclusions as you have based on the same methods that you have applied. So you should always state all your inputs, all the stuff you've done. It should be written in a way that makes it possible for others to, if they wish to replicate what you have done. If they get to other answers, or if they get to the same answer as you, well, fine. That's part of the game. You could say the next point here is somewhat well, people are debating this, of course, or because there may be examples of, you could say, science that isn't this obviously generalized from, but in, let's say, in most circumstances, it's nice to say that the study that you are performing has values outside the study itself. So it's not only within your domain, within your little studio or your little lab that you can get the results that you get, but you should try to look out what does this mean for others in other connections, in other circumstances. Look outward. It should be structured in a logical and theory based way. So it should be a structured process that you are applying. One that may be difficult now and then, at least when you see master thesis at an initial level, is that the answers should actually be possible. The study that you're performing should be possible. The questions that you ask shouldn't be so ambitious that it's more or less impossible to get to the correct answers. So you should try to make something that's doable in a way. And of course, the cyclical thing, it should generate new questions. So it shouldn't give the definite answer to something. It should suggest, of course, maybe now and then a good answer, but hardly the definitive answer that comes in the end. I mentioned this incremental thing, but it should also be apolitical and show some social responsibility. Well, feel free to look at the others. I won't go into detail. They are, because a lot of these lists are kind of similar, and the important thing here is that they all tend to refer to the cyclical nature of research. And the fact that you should write things in a way that makes it possible for others to judge whether the conclusions are good or not, and that it should be replicable. So you can find a number of these. You can find others in the textbook. While I remember that. Maybe a little bit of a sidestep. The textbook you have for the course, it's not a very theoretical book, but it's chosen in this course because it has a lot of checklists that you can apply later. So I think it's a good book to have. I know that a lot of you don't buy that many books. You access them on the net, but in this case, it could be a good idea because you may want to use different kinds of checklists and stuff like that, that you can use later. So it's a very practical kind of book, I would say. So, we talk about the... I talk a lot here now about the, you could say, the... the experiment. What's a good experiment? We talk about a very ideal type of research, a very highbrow, or a very maybe a difficult target to reach. And some of you, well, I don't want to do academics. I don't want to read a lot of theory and do experiments in the lab. I just want to make something. I want to develop something. I want to create this super cool application that makes the world a nicer place to be, or whatever. Can I do that? Is that science? Is that part of a master thesis, for instance? Well, absolutely, it can be. But there is a few things that you have to think about. Because you're not expected to just develop it. You are expected to discuss it, to reflect upon your results or on your product. What is it? Was there a reason I made this? Did this solve a problem? And why did it solve this problem? And did it create new problems maybe on the way there? Why have others failed before me? What have I done that's different from what others have tried before me? These are possible questions. When does it work? When is it actually a good product? When is it actually a good application compared to other applications? But when does it fail? Also, this is things you are obliged to reflect on. Did you have to make compromises? Were there shortcomings in your product? And why were they there? And, of course, how can things be improved? Can it be improved? I've made this super cool product, but can it be even better? What would be the roadmap from here? And these are all reflections that adds, you could say, a science flavor, or at least an analytic flavor, to more type of product developments. When I use products here in a very broad sense. It can be an algorithm, it can be an application, it can be a math formula for all I know. The point is, you can always reflect on these things, and you're expected to do that. You're not expected just to make something, you're expected to reflect around it, and that makes it scientific. So I will in this course apply apply a very narrow-minded approach to scientific work, or to research in a more general sense. My focus will be on what we typically call empirical research in this connection. Quantitative empirical research, where numbers usually are are part of stuff. We analyze things, we gather information that we try to analyze. There is a reason I do this. Well, of course, one is that the course is not that big. But the other thing is that when we do this, at least we touch the central terminologies that we also use in other, could say, branches of research. So of course, but there are other ways of doing things. I'm focusing, as I said, on hypothesis testing, on being very reductional, trying to focus on a very narrow research question, gather data to answer a hypothesis that I have developed based on the theories that I use. Very narrow, very strict. Of course, that is good research, but that's not the only way to do research. There are a lot of other ways to do it, which is just as good. I'm not judging any qualities here. And some of these strategies are strategies that you probably will choose later. Because you have what's called constructivist approaches, where you're more focused on understanding the underlying foundations of a phenomena, for instance, where you describe and explain and generate new theories on more like uncertain grounds. You have the more advocacy type of approaches, which some of you who works with information security, and especially on the organizational field, will apply, which where the researcher tends to be part of a system which he wants to change. So he's part of the process of change here. It's a lot of the soundproofing of these two auditoriums is not perfect to be mild. So there are different ways of doing this. We can do it also. Many of you will probably use a pragmatic approach where you are doing things more in a real life situation where it's difficult to do a good hypothesis testing, but at least where you can gather some data, analyze data. All this is good, but I'm referring a lot to empirical research, and the reason is that's where the concepts are clearest and easiest to understand. But it's not the only way to do research, and it's not superior to other approaches. Another distinction that is done now and then is the distinction between what you can call experimental methods and non-experimental methods. Many of my examples will come from experimental methodologies, where we actually do experiments or quasi-experiments. I'll get to the distinction later. But there are other ways of doing things. Most often used one is what you can call qualitative research compared to quantitative research, where we analyze problems rather than gather data on an issue. Correlational research that has to do with numbers, but where we just look at the relationship between two phenomena. Without doing any hypothesis testing, we look at the relationship between ice cream consumption and temperature, or something like that. Which is it's not deductive. It can be, but it's a stupid example. I know it's too obvious. But you see, a lot of science are doing this, only correlating things without actually trying to prove anything. They're just looking at relationships. That can be good as well. Historical research, going back in time, seeing how things have changed, developed, finding ways to visualize changes can be good. I don't remember the name of this Swedish, did anyone of you remember him? The Swedish sociologist, I think he was, has had all these shows where he has gone into, yeah. Rosling, that's right, Hans Rosling. Where he's done a lot of, you could say, experiments on how to visualize change over time. And of course, it's not quantitative methodology, it's numbers. But it has more to do with visualizing things than it has to do with actually proving anything. It's not coming up with statistical significances, for instance, which is a term we will refer to a lot. But it's world-class science in its way. So I just say this to be clear that science is not just one thing. It can be a lot of different things. I'll skip a little bit of... I'll go back to some of this stuff later, but I have to get to the end here to give you a little task for that you should bring to next week. And that means I need to get to a few of these, the key terms. And that brings us to one of the core issues in research, and that is to formulate a good research question. I'd say this is kind of common for all the different approaches. Most scientific work, most different ways of doing this, goes into or tries to formulate a research problem in a good way. And it's usually the starting point of all research. It takes a while to get there, because you usually have to have many iterations to get to a good research problem or research question. But it's the starting point. And it's usually in the form of a question. You wonder about something. Will people behave differently if I apply this method? If I use this learning method, will children learn to read easier? It should, of course, be more specific. But this is a. We'll get to many examples of good research questions later. But the point is that there are some criteria that should be met in order to say that you have a research question at hand. And one of these is that they should relate to some variables. Something should affect something else. So you should say something about the different elements of information you put into the equation here. Something leads to something else. Men and women are have different IQs. That's just, of course, you know this isn't true. So I just take this as a just stupid example. But that would be such a, that would say something about relationships. It says that there is a difference between that gender affects intelligence. So we have an independent variable. I'll go to the definition afterwards. We have an independent variable that affects a dependent variable in some way. And the dependent variable, what's depending on gender, is then intelligence. In this case, it's not true, right? Just to It was a vulgar kind of example, but it, when it came up, I have to stick to it, right? Let's just take this definition right away. The independent variable is the variable that either is existing as part of a situation, or something that we introduce in order to explain something else. So it can be in my area in psychology, it can be treatment, for instance, but also different programs, different user interfaces, different organizational strategies to improve safety or security in an organization. All these things would be independent variable things that either are there from the beginning, like gender, or that you introduce, like two versions of a program or something else, or the existing situation compared to something else. That independent variables, and they create changes in something else. Intelligence, safety culture, the tendency to give away personal information, I don't know, performance, how fast you perform an action that we want you to perform. Those are dependent variables. And one of the things you're going to do in the first assignment that I give you, that I will introduce next week, is to actually identify dependent and independent variables in the research. It's a really basic core concept, but it's surprisingly difficult to do now and then. But it's important because you know that the one thing is what you manipulate, the other thing is what you measure. And they can be discrete, like the independent variable can be discrete, like gender, but it's not necessarily discrete. It can be a continuous one. It can be some size thing. It can be weight. It can be temperature. I don't know. Well, that's usually the... And the same variable can be two things in different connections. So now and then... It's not fixed. Like, well, let's take the one with temperature. Maybe it's difficult to find a good example. Temperature and... Well, in some connections, let's say, if you look at the relationship between ice cream sales and temperature, you would probably treat... temperature as the independent variable, because that's the one that you predict affects ice cream sales. But it is possible to think of it in a reverse way as well. The number of clouds in the sky affects temperature, for instance. Then clouds in the sky would be the independent variable, and temperature will be the dependent variable. So this has to be analyzed from, you could say, report to report and experiment to experiment. And it's kind of important as a personal tool to when you read science. But one key thing here is to be able to, well, in order to make this possible to put into an equation or in a scientific way. Where you state the relationship between variables, the variables need to be specific enough to actually be measurable in a way, to be be possible to single out. And a term we use around this, you can find other terms, it could be specification, but I call them now operationalization of concepts. It means what do we mean by the concepts we state? What do we mean by the our variables? Because fuzzy concepts are hard to measure. So we usually need to cut them down into measurable objects in some way. And take a statement like this. It can be solved in many ways, and the way you solve it may also affect the way you the methods that you apply, and it may affect the ability to replicate studies. So take this example. I'm wondering, this is a research question, did the Lillehammer Olympics in 94 make people in this region more happy? That's my research question. I'm running a consultancy who's going to try to investigate this, and I get a lot of room space to find this out. So first, anyone, what is the there is, no matter how you treat this, there is obviously an independent and a dependent variable present here. Can anyone give me the independent variable based on what I told you so far? Any suggestions? Lillehammer Olympics. When that happened, that was something that happened. So it wasn't there before, and it came, and that created a change. And that is the independent variable. Lillehammer Olympics and before before and after Lillehammer Olympics. Or now I'm going into the definition already, but this one is the operationalization already. But this one was pretty obvious. But what's the dependent one then? That's the other, right? You don't have to answer that. That's too obvious. More happy, right? But that's more of a difficult one. The first one, Lillehammer Olympics or not, which was the independent variable, that's easy. It's obvious what we're after there. It's either there or not. But happiness, what is that? Okay? Absolutely. It has to be defined. It's a fussy word here. I was coming to that as a further complication here. Because what we mean by region, maybe people in Gjøvik became less happy and people in Lillehammer became more happy, I'm not sure. Because of envy or whatever. Yes, a good point. Very good point. But let's take the fussy one then. Happy. In order to say something about the relationship between Lillehammer Olympics and happiness, we need to define happiness. Right? Scale of happiness, you say. Yeah, maybe there is a scale of happiness. Maybe there is an international questionnaire standardized to measure happiness. And of course, that would be the way to define this is then happiness as measured by the international renowned questionnaire for happiness measurement or something like that. There is probably a good acronym for that. That could be one way to operationalize this. Any other suggestions? Because the point is here, when I say as measured by, yeah. Suggestion? you can define your own way of measuring it, of course. And this can have to do with creativity. I know that one approach that has have been tried, this is in a purely because a quantitative way, is to count the number of smiles in the pedestrian street in Lillehammer every Saturday over a period. So, but again, that would be, of course, all this is to narrow, that may be something completely different from the measurement, the other measurement scale. And you may come to very different conclusions, but you need to be specific in order to make this readable for someone else. You see the point here. You need to operationalize your variables in order to make them into part of your research and in order to be able to understand what you mean by them yourself and in order to find good methodologies in your research. And some concepts may be kind of complex in this connection. So what I'd like you to do till next week, we'll start next Wednesday morning with a little discussion where we where you try to identify independent and dependent variables in these two well, let's say broad questions that I raise. And try to identify which terms actually needs to be operationalized further, if they're needed to be operationalized further. And come up with suggestions for this operationalization. And the first one is a specific attitude campaign will reduce speeding on highways. How can we approach a problem like this? Well, how can we describe variables and operationalize them? Which variables do we need to operationalize? Difficult word in English, this one. And I've given you an example here. This you can, if you drive along the Norwegian roads, there is a large campaign called Over Fartsgrensen, where you see part of that is, well, it's a lot of it's commercials on TV and stuff, but it's also signs along the roads, like the one you see to the right here. Signs that says Over Fartsgrensen. Question mark. Does this work? How would you approach a problem like this? What variables are involved? And how could you operationalize the variables? So the first one is kind of specific. It's easy. But try the other one.